Hello, and welcome to Runway Girl Network in Conversation, a deep dive into aviation and the passenger experience. I'm RGN contributing editor John Walton, and today I'm in conversation with Aaron Yong, a design partner at Lift Aero Design, based in Singapore and specialising in airline interiors and branding. Aaron, welcome to In Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
How are things in Singapore?
Besides the sweat rolling down my cheeks, yeah, it's everything's fine. Compared to the rest of the world, we can't really complain at this point. As far as the numbers game goes, we've got it pretty good compared to the rest of the world, and we're at the point where the only way is up right now. I think there were fears of a second wave and didn't really happen, so
yeah, I must admit to a little bit of envy sitting here in in the area of France that is, well, yeah, in some ways one of the epicenters of the second wave here. We're at the very end of October recording this, and we're looking very much like we're going to be in another at least 4 week long lockdown. But you know, we managed the first time; we shall manage again.
Mm-hmm. You will, you know, you will. Definitely.
Humans are a resilient people,
absolutely.
And you know, as indeed is the aviation industry. Now, with you know, Singapore is not alone in Asia in having a relatively relatively greater level of control over the situation. And I'm seeing a number of air corridors that have been opening. And so one of them is between Hong Kong and Singapore. Can you tell us a little bit about that for our listeners who might not be up to date with what's happening on your side of the world?
Yeah, so, well, Singapore has actually established several so-called travel corridors with a few countries in the last few months. I think we've got one with New Zealand, although that one's not mutual. That's the other thing. So some are unilateral and some are mutual. And so we've just, I think the latest news was that we established one with Germany as well. We've got one with Japan was announced, Malaysia, China. But the interesting thing about the Hong Kong one is that it's the first one that is not just for essential travel. And that's a big game changer. So for all the other travel corridors that have been announced or arranged, you basically, it's kind of making a really, really inconvenient situation just that little bit less inconvenient by kind of speeding up the process. There's still testing and what have you. But at the end of the day, you should not be traveling, and they advise against it. It's unless you absolutely have to for essential business. With the Hong Kong announcement, what they're basically saying is, and they haven't set the date yet, by the way, but when they do, they will be allowing leisure travel. And I believe that Hong Kong will be the first destination to have this sort of non-essential travel corridor open up with Singapore. I'm pretty sure Singapore is pretty anxious to get as many going as possible, you know, because as a city with no hinterland, no domestic market, a country with no domestic market, no domestic travel whatsoever, it's really, really important that we open the borders and international travel as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what's the situation if you do have to arrive into Singapore right now? Is it a full test and quarantine protocol?
Yeah. Yes. So basically, to give you a quick rundown of how it's been since the borders de facto closed, all Singaporeans, basically anyone arriving into Singapore since, I think it was April or May, has had to undergo a mandatory 14-day quarantine. Now, this it's an actual quarantine, it's not a self quarantine like a lot of countries are doing. You're literally whisked away from the airport into a hotel room that's been set up just in a hotel that has already been designated as a quarantine location, and you literally cannot leave the room for that 2 week period. And so it is pretty strict. It's all laid out. That's what people are expecting. Tons of Singaporeans were returning and they had to all go through this. It's all paid for by the government, provided you are returning having left Singapore before COVID erupted. So if you decided to, so basically that's the other thing is if you've decided to leave, nothing's really stopping you from leaving right now. Our borders, there's no law saying you can't go on holiday right now to anywhere you want it that would have you. But the catch is that on your arrival, on your return, sorry, you would have to foot the bill of that quarantine in a hotel for 2 weeks on your own. And in addition to that, up until recently, I think it was, they just announced a revisal of this. If you were to contract COVID, you would not be entitled to subsidized healthcare, which you would if you had not voluntarily gone abroad and come home with the virus. So
Right.
that's basically how it stands, and that's what Singaporeans have been looking at for the last few months, and or not just Singaporeans, but anyone who's wanted to come to Singapore for whatever reason. And so if you basically you have to really want to come into Singapore to be putting up with that 2 week hotel stay. It's not I know that in some countries they most in most countries I think they you declare a place that you're going to quarantine yourself and you're expected to stay there of your own accord. But in Singapore it's pretty micromanaged in that respect.
I mean, that sounds, in terms of the hotel and the lock-in aspect, as
Yes.
it were, that sounds a lot like the Australian and New Zealand kind of
Yes.
situation. But yeah, look, it's strict, and to be honest, that's probably why your rate is significantly less than many of the rates in other
Yeah.
countries which have not had
There
quite so strict a set of lockdowns.
was a spike a few months ago in foreign worker dormitories, which basically sent the national number soaring because you know it's really close quarters and it really shone a light on the conditions that these people are living in. And you know all it took was a couple of people to get it, and it really the numbers just ballooned from there. And so that's I think that was something that they were really focused on bringing down, and they actually have, to give them credit. So the numbers as it stands, we literally like in Singapore you can subscribe to government updates via WhatsApp, via Telegram, and you literally they will text you every day and tell you what the latest COVID count was for the day. And you know what? I'm gonna look at my government
This
message
is a
today
very
right now.
Singaporean thing, and I absolutely
Yes, you know
love
what?
it.
Okay, and it literally says here, as of 12 p.m., the Ministry of Health has preliminarily confirmed that there are no new cases of locally transmitted COVID-19 infection. There are seven imported cases who had all been placed on a stay home notice upon arrival in Singapore. Yeah, so I think they've relaxed that sort of big scary hotel stay now, and I think that's mostly in exceptional circumstances. I think depending on the country where they've come from, they will assess it, and I think quite a few people will fall into the category of just being told to stay home, and then they just check up on you and things like that. So it's been it's whatever some may think of the measures, they've definitely been effective. The numbers speak for themselves, I think, and it's I think. And it's unfortunate to make the comparison, but seeing some parts of the world like Europe and North America start having numbers go up again at this point really puts into perspective, I think. So people here are understanding. I think we generally get that all of this is necessary. And we've also kind of got like phases. So there was that full-on lockdown thing that happened for about a couple of months. That was April and May, where we were literally you couldn't go out of the house unless it's for something really important or to for groceries. And then there was phase one where it was very gradual, like a few people started going back to work, but other than that, it was almost the same as a lockdown. Then phase two, which we're still living in right now, which feels like business as usual, except that everything has to shut down by 10:30 p.m. and there's enforced distancing, like government mandated distancing at all restaurants, shops, everything. And it's kind of become, I think people have started getting used to it.
And it's interesting because in that context, you have Singapore Airlines, for example, which is trying to do a lot of as much as it can to keep flying, including with the return and the extension of the world's longest flight, which was previously from Singapore Changi to Newark across the Hudson River from New York, but it's now going to JFK. Obviously, with the arrival situation in Singapore pretty complicated, that's going to do something to demand. So what do you think about this whole situation? Who's going to be flying this? Or is it really just a cargo flight with a few passengers on board?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the cargo thing, because from what I understand, one of the factors for them choosing JFK instead of Newark is that they have, SIA has their own, or they have a cargo handling facility in JFK that they don't in Newark. And it's pretty safe to assume that cargo makes up a big chunk of the reason to be flying this route. Like everything I've said leading up to this, like laying it out, what all the barriers that are in place, you can see how you won't exactly have a lot of visitors to Singapore. The other way around is actually, from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, but the US hasn't closed its borders to a lot of countries, actually, have they? Like, they're not...
No, I mean, that would be bolting the stable door, but in only one direction and in the wrong direction.
Yeah. So, I mean, technically, there's nothing really stopping me from hopping on that flight right now to go to New York, my wallet notwithstanding. So, if you wanted to come the other way, that you have to be prepared for what's on the other end. And obviously, Singapore is not going to be adding the US to any travel corridor arrangement anytime soon.
No.
But it is interesting that they've chosen to reinstate that route. It's also interesting that they've the route is technically a bit longer than the Newark one. But they're, from what I understand, they are not declaring it their longest route in their route network, and that distinction stays with the Newark flights.
Yeah, and I think it's all about what 5 kilometers more or whatever. Yeah, it is.
But they've basically done a bit of scheduling tweaking to such that on a technicality the EWR flight is still technically the longest.
Oh, it's time blocked for longer Airlines rather than okay. Network.
Yes, it's right, like 5 minutes longer on paper.
Well, I mean, and that makes sense on paper because, look, if you're going to fill a plane, even, you know, one of their, all business plus a bit of premium economy ULR aircraft rather than this, which is going to be the regular standard A350.
It is, yes.
You know, even if you're going to fill a plane, it's going to take an extra 5 minutes to get people on and off, I guess. But it is amusing to me that they've decided that know what's important here is to make sure that our world record flight is still still their
flagship
there.
They don't have to make any revisions to their flagship press material or anything. And yeah, it is interesting that they're using the standard range A350 with the 3-class configuration, because, well, the first thing that came to my mind was that they're obviously not expecting a full load of passengers, and so they can afford the payload restrictions that might come with such a route on that aircraft, and not as opposed to the ULR version. It probably doesn't matter very much at this point what the cabin configuration is, because it's not going to be full either way.
Right. But it's interesting that they've put that in place rather than doing something like the onward hop from Frankfurt as the as the option, which is what in the before times, that's what they used to do with the A380s, right? The A380s would go to Frankfurt, and one of the A380s would do that extra hop on to JFK. And yeah, it's fascinating to me that that's that they decided that New York is going to be the destination. And I, you know, obviously, I wonder if that's got something to do with the, you know, fact that the United Nations is there, and if they're doing anything around, you know, there's been a request from your Ministry of Foreign Affairs to basically provide a way for essential Singaporeans to travel, to continue to travel, or whether there is indeed that incoming demand. I mean, Singapore's importance as an, you know, an Asian and particularly Southeast Asian financial centre has only been growing in recent years, and you know, it seems to me that there could well be people who whose companies say, actually, you know what, we do need you in Singapore for the next 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, and Zoom just isn't going to cut it. So you know, we'll here's your medical card and a large pile of cash.
Well, it is interesting actually that you mentioned the Frankfurt the Fifth Freedom flight, because that probably if you think that if you think about it, in the era of COVID, where you're basically trying to avoid as much sort of crowded contact as possible, obviously non-stop flights are preferable to ones with transits. And so if you I suppose if you want to go to New York from Singapore, and you want the lowest COVID risk possible, I mean, you definitely wouldn't want to be transiting in Europe right now. I don't I'm not necessarily saying Frankfurt is a risky place to be transiting, but it certainly I think it would factor in. And I think the traffic between Europe and the US, of course, they I mean, obviously these are people we're all just armchair speculating at this point. But yeah, it definitely I think the transit factor in the age of COVID is definitely important to consider. And I think all the European flights as well, as far as I know, have all been downgauged to A350s as well. Actually, I believe they recently announced, I think it was last month, that their route network for December, and I think they've reinstated quite a few European destinations, like the slightly thinner routes like Copenhagen and Amsterdam. So that's also encouraging for, I mean, for the industry in general, really, that it seems to be picking up.
Well, indeed. You know, just fingers crossed that the second wave starts to plateau swiftly, so that's going to be, you know, an option. Because look, obviously we're coming up to the Christmas holidays, but you know, it's not like any allotment was made for changes to protocols for Eid, or like there's a lot going to be made for Diwali, or indeed, you know, sort of slightly earlier this year, Hanukkah. So it's really, you know, it's one of those things where we're trying to figure out exactly what each family should and can do. So yeah, and it's this whole question of you know, in cabin safety is a fascinating one. Obviously, over the last month or so, we had a spate of research, whether that was pre-published or pre-submitted, or study of studies sort of research looking at the early transmission of COVID-19 within cabins and within among travelling groups. Some of which basically said, well, we haven't been able to detect anything, at which point IATA, of course, turns around and says, flying is safer than you're less likely to be infected than be struck by lightning, which, you know, I think was perhaps an unhelpful intervention in terms of safety. Now, of course, we have a growing number of studies which are either funded by the aviation industry saying it's perfectly fine, or not, and flagging up some issues. So, for example, you have the case of a flight into Ireland, which was, I believe, there was something like 49 people on board, of whom 13 are known to have contracted the exact same genomic identifier variant of COVID-19, and the only commonality of these people who came from three separate continents and transited in an airport that is probably Doha, but was not identified. The only thing that they had in common was the fact that they took this one flight. Now, of course, we don't know whether it was that they, you know, were too close in the boarding gate area. One assumes that that's been adequately spaced, or that you know, perhaps they were all in the queue in Dublin for an hour, which again doesn't seem hugely likely. It seems much more likely that this was on aircraft. But you know, all of that means that the cabin is still an area of much question right now. Now, you're a cabin designer. Obviously, we've seen a lot of cabins over the recent years trying to avoid that kind of wall of beige, which is the, you know, there's exposed thermoplastics in giant sheets, which are, I suppose, rather inherently easy to clean. And now people are wanting, you know, rather than a sort of broken up cabin, to see a visible lack of dirtiness. You know, visibly clean is the trend, but it's, you know, trying to see something that isn't there. What's that looking like for you? How are you addressing that as a designer?
Well, I think from our end, a lot of it, well, first of all, a lot of it that we're working on is, at this point, is a lot of blue skies work, because it's all happened so quickly. It's not, and in the first place, one has to realize and remember that with the industry in recovery mode, spending on design features, cabin enhancements, physical cabin enhancements, is going to be taking a backseat for a while, as far as airline spending goes. But for us in the design world, we definitely want to put forth some ideas where we are taking, that show that we're taking people's fears into consideration. And the thing is that there's so much flying around, pardon the pun, there's too many different opinions on what constitutes a safe environment, a clean environment, because we know that what you see isn't necessarily representative of how sanitary a surface in an aircraft might be. But on the other hand, it is important psychologically for the passenger to feel like they are in a very clean space. Now, at this point, like I said, because not a lot of immediate work is going to be happening to aircraft interiors, it really comes down to what airlines can do with what they already have. And some interior designs will certainly lend themselves better to appearing clean than others. Some, unfortunately, and this will be a lesson for designers in the future, some, unfortunately, will have designs or colors or patterns that, no matter how sanitary, how sanitized, how spotlessly clean they are, will always kind of look a little bit grubby because of, you know, just harmless wear and tear. And that will certainly be something to take into consideration for designs going forward, because even outside of a COVID context, all these things do matter. We do think about these things already when we're designing cabins pre-pandemic. You know, how long will this hold up? Will this carpet hold up? How long will this fabric hold up? It looks beautiful now. Is it going to look as beautiful in a year after thousands of cycles? And when you compound that with people's heightened sensitivities to, you know, perceived dirtiness, perceived uncleanliness, then all of that becomes even more important. It's important in the sort of, I mean, there's a lot of talk in, as far as industrial design goes, as to what sort of arrangements we can have, what sort of you know, privacy screens and isolation, sort of isolating designs that you can do. But the CMF aspect is also really important. And so when it comes down to the choices of colors, materials, that all of that has to be given, I think, even more priority than even more consideration than it did before. And it also is a reminder, I think, that this is, well, in aviation, this is always a long game, right? Because the process, the gestation period for any new product is so long that by the time, you know, we're literally, we are lift included, are in caught in the middle of projects that were well underway before the pandemic broke out, and will be completed after the pandemic, after, realistically speaking, after a vaccine has been developed. So that's just the, working within these challenges of our time frames, and you know, is always at the back of our minds. A lot of the proposals that have been put out there, there are some really interesting proposals out there by different design agencies, and all to varying degrees of I should say, realistic potential. But yeah, I think from our perspective, and what we're not seeing enough, I think, is that focus on perception. Because on the back end, we know, at least we in the aviation industry know, and we have faith in our colleagues across the industry, that they're doing everything they can to create a safe and clean environment for their passengers. It's their environment as well, and we know that it's going to be clean. It's going to be as clean as they can make it. Let's put it that way. But convincing the customer is a different ball game, and so that's where I think design can really help. How we've chosen to design something that might not even be very different, but you know, things like even a simple material choice, for example. I think people I think passengers, the average passenger, will pick up, for example, that leather or even faux leather is definitely easier to clean than fabric, than a textile. And that, you can imagine this going into play in someone's mind when they're clambering into a seat and sitting down and wondering to themselves, just how clean is this seat? How much dust is it harboring? Have they really cleaned this as effectively as they can? If it's a smooth surface like leather, it's that a bit of that goes away because it's a bit easier for the passenger in their own layman's terms to adjudge the situation and to decide for themselves whether they think it's clean or not.
Yeah, and in many way cases to take their either their airline provided alcohol wipe or their, you know, Naomi mm-hmm. Campbell style Dettol wipe that they've brought from home to take it into their own hands. And that's
an interesting point as well, because I think there was a bit of hesitance. I can understand the hesitance at first to provide cleaning kits like that in the beginning, because it kind of, you do run the risk of insinuating that additional cleaning steps are needed, right? So it's kind of like, you know, analogous of should a train have seatbelts? If you could add a seatbelt and probably make it safer, but if I did add a seatbelt to the train, you probably feel less safe because you're wondering, why do I need a seatbelt in the first place? So it is, and I think that providing you know, little sanitary kits, sanitizing kits for people, I think most people will appreciate them. Some people might take it the wrong way, but I think that was what I was thinking at first, and I think some people in the industry were a bit concerned about that. But then you reach the point where if most airlines are giving them out, you don't want to be the airline that isn't, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of the same with the actual, you know, onboard cleaning protocols. We've seen a couple of airlines this year. They missed, for example, something in the seat back pocket, and then, you know, people get on the airplane and they think, hang on, why is there something in the seat back pocket? How did this get missed? And what does that mean for the rest of the cleaning protocol, right? And that's really interesting to me, is in terms of how that you can easily spot if something is dirty. You can't easily tell if something is cleaned.
Exactly.
Right? It could just have been missed or skipped. And I think that's going to be really interesting. I mean, we've seen a lot of designers and suppliers talking about using antimicrobial methods, whether that's an applied coating or whether it's something that's created inherently in the material during its manufacture. But then how do you then flag up to passengers that, oh, this is a whatever it is in terms of the actual material, how you flag them, say actually yes, this is a safer material. This material mm-hmm. is itself antimicrobial, and then how does that then affect what people do to it, right?
Yes.
If part of the of one of the reasons why we might be being safer is that people are still inherently wearing masks because it makes sense and they're avoiding doing the anecdotal thing where people will bring a coffee and then spend the entire flight drinking their coffee and just not put their mask back on. it's this kind of perverse incentive situation. And so you end up sort of thinking, okay, what are the ways to communicate this in the best I guess almost an industrial psychology way, and how to design both the item, the structure, the seat, whatever it is, and figure out how passengers are going to use it, and then how you explain it to passengers is, it feels like that's more important than ever.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, assuming we have the opportunity to get a new product to market, for example, that's a new seating product to market that's designed with all of this in mind. I think visual cues for certain things that set it apart from something in the past that hasn't considered sanitization and cleanliness so heavily are important for the passenger. So, and it can be as simple as even the use of color, for example, with mood lighting, with certain hues, like blue, for example, is a much more clinical color normally, and it's not usually the something you'd go for when you want to suggest warmth. But in a time when people are concerned about hygiene, it's certainly a more desirable thing to be clinical of all things. And I think you mentioned highlighting to people whether or not a material was, I guess you could say, special in any way, slightly better for hygiene in any way, antimicrobial or whatever. And there's lots of ways to go about that. I personally tend to gravitate towards the least environmentally impactful option, because it's very easy to say, okay, so now we're gonna give everyone a little card that says your seat has been specially designed to with all this in mind, from an antibacterial fabric that practically cleans itself, and we're our flight attendant and we wipe this plane down every few hours. But I think there are smarter ways to do that. I think with the use of technology and with design cues as well, that kind of, you could have sort of, you could be something as simple as having permanently printed elements on, or permanently or debossed elements of the seating product that state its function, that state its antibacterial properties or something. There's a lot to explore there, I think. And also when it comes to design, the topic of nesting came up recently in where we're a bit more sensitive now as to all these different nooks and crannies in that previously were purposefully designed to give you more space, more places to put your things, more ways to hide yourself from the next passenger. Now they are a bit of a liability because they are all possibly dirt and bacteria trapping places. And so future designs, I think, are also going to keep that in mind, have a bit less complex surfaces, and not just less complex in their construction, but visibly so, so that the passenger can see that this is easy to clean. This is, you know, there aren't any going to be hidden surfaces here and there. And like I said, yeah, treat it with whatever design decisions in color and material to reassure the passenger, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It's all fascinating just to think about how designers are going to be incorporating this in both the current generation of seats, which are, you know, really, as you say, in production and will be produced during and after this pandemic, but also the next round of design seats. Fascinating stuff. Now, this is already a bit of a bumper episode, but I wanted to end on a bit of a fun note. So in Singapore Airlines has been doing all sorts of things around reminding people of the passenger experience. So let's talk about that. First, let's talk about the on-ground dining experience that they've been offering. Aaron, tell us about this, because it sounds great to me. I'm not going to lie.
I wish I could tell you from a first-hand experience, first of all, but alas, I could not stomach the asking price. It is, to be fair, as far as novelties go, it's I think it's a pretty good use of a grounded plane. I think it really sheds a lot of light onto the plight of an airline that has no domestic market to speak of when borders are closed, right? So they really have to go all out and be pretty creative.
Yep. And they're literally just sort of parking a Singapore Airlines A380 at a gate at Changi, boarding people on it and giving them dinner.
And it's interesting that, yeah, I mean, like not just any airline could do this, right? You have to have, and I guess this is what separate certain airlines that capitalize on the experience a lot, and it really comes into play even when the plane is not even flying, even when you're not even going to a destination, because they've built the brand so strongly that the mere experience of being on a Singapore Airlines flight in a Singapore Airlines cabin, being served by Singapore Airlines crew, is considered desirable on some level. And so not every airline could pull this off. They also have the hard product to back it up. They have deployed their latest A380 product, and rightfully so, they'd want to show it off. And I think it was a great strategy for a lot of people who otherwise might not get a chance to fly this. Even if you're someone who does fly regularly, if you may be a well-heeled individual, but you may not necessarily be on these limited routes that this specific product flies on. You might not find yourself ever in that business class seat, which is the best one, which is the most up-to-date one in SQ's fleet. Even frequent business travelers, it still might be new to them. So it was, I think it was a great opportunity for them to show off the hard product. The food aspect, of course, that's also a way for them to show off what they can do with the in-flight dining experience. But I think, to be honest, most people are really, really bought into it because of the fact that it was on a plane. And of all planes, the flagship of one of the most highly regarded airlines in the world. So we all know by now that the prices are not cheap. They were, but again, you're paying for the novelty. And I think, and let's keep in mind that they did sell out really quickly. The entire, all four cabins, all four classes were on sale. So you could be paying something like 60 Singapore dollars for an economy class experience all the way up to, I think, don't quote me on this, but I think 500 to 600 Singapore dollars for a suites experience. So, yeah, and I think it was, you know, it's the best they could have done with the situation. You mentioned the Chris Shop as well, that they've definitely capitalized on as well, and it's all sold through there. Of course, these are things that airlines have been doing for years, but now the catch is that they've opened up a lot of, Chris Shop, for example, which is their in-flight duty-free catalog, which also has a website that also does home deliveries, has been focusing a lot more on the home delivery side during COVID, because that's another
because not a lot of duty free right now.
Revenue.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so opening up a lot of the retail opportunities for that normally were reserved for in-flight sales. Now they're giving like things, even things like liquor and electronics that normally would be subject to duties, they would be selling them domestically in Singapore and absorbing a lot of the cost as well. And so basically incentivizing people to keep engaging with the airline brand, with the airline, with the airline product, you know, on this, on the face of it, I myself have been happy to order from them because you get, it's kind of the best of both worlds. You know, you don't have to fly and you still get your mileage perks or whatever. And of course there, everything is priced pretty aggressively in this time. So they're doing whatever they can, and it's quite understandable, especially for an airline, like I said, that hasn't got any domestic market to sustain them through this period.
Yeah. And to me, it's fascinating about how the brand equity which the airline has invested, and let's be very clear, this is a financial investment as well as as anything else, over the years, you know, even if that's, you know, going back all the way to, you know, the 1969 Pierre Balmain Seron Kabay addresses, right, which I think is probably the greatest investment in a piece of airline branding ever, right? You know, it's the same year as Concorde, which has outlasted, the same year as the 747, which it's outlasted. It's fascinating to me how much benefit that it has been very clear that that can bring to an airline in a time of crisis. And I think that's something for, you know, once we all get flying again, hopefully next year, fingers crossed. You know, once things start to, you know, return to, not even return to, once we start to find where the new normal is, and airlines start to think about how they position themselves, how they discover who they are in the post-COVID world, and who their travelers are and who their customers are. That's certainly something to think about. And Aaron, thank you. It's been a very, very thought-provoking conversation today. Listeners, we certainly hope that you've enjoyed it, and we're always keen to find out what you think. Please feel free to email me at john@ronaldmcgillnetwork.com with any suggestions. Aaron, thank you for joining us today. Where can folks continue the conversation with you online?
Well, I'm on most socials at Aaron Samuel Yong. That's my name spelled out. And we're also with Lyft at lyft.aero. It's exactly how it sounds. We've got some interesting products in the pipeline. We can't wait to share. It's unusual to be optimistic in this time, but we are looking on the bright side, and we're looking forward to sharing what we've been working on with the world as soon as we can. And hopefully that we really stand in solidarity with everyone in aviation, you know, and depending on what job you are employed with, it can range from mildly inconvenienced to extremely tough. And so our thoughts go out to everyone affected by this crisis, especially in our industry as well.
Yeah, ours too. As ever, listeners, you can find me on Twitter at @thatjohn and everything from RGN on Twitter at @runwaygirl and, of course, at runwaygirlnetwork.com. If you enjoy these conversations, please do leave a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.